Welcome back to the Gentleman Ultras podcast. We are back again and we are continuing with our series on Italy at the Euros. We've already discussed the disastrous 1992 campaign, the indifferent 1996 campaign, and now we're moving forward to Euro 2000. This is going to cause some controversy on how, maybe on the squad list, but certainly it's a bit better. A bit more as well for us to talk about, especially more than the Euro 92 one. Emmett, I'm joined by you as always. How are you today? You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm actually looking forward to talking about a squad that's not as controversial and Italy actually make a deep run in this tournament for a change. So yeah, at least we have a lot more to talk about now than the previous two episodes.
Absolutely. Well, we'll start. We'll get straight into the squad. But just before we do get into the squad, this kit, Emmett. I mean, we'd love to talk about kit on the Gents of Military. But after 1990, I know you mentioned about 96, but this after 1990 is the one for me.
I mean, you have a period of about maybe 25 years where Italy, every single home shirt is gorgeous. There isn't a period. Maybe the jersey that Nike first produced, not a fan of it, but literally from the Diadora era right through to Nike, the Kappa, and then the beginning of the Puma era, just beautiful shirts. And this one especially, this was at the beginning of the Kappa making shirts that were tight fit, you know, obviously because players pulling other players' shirts had become a big thing around this time. So Kappa devised this solution, would make the shirts ultra tight so defenders can't pull back strikers. And this was, I think this was the first tournament where the tight shirts came into play. But this is just a gorgeous shirt. Like just, this is one for the list. I know we talked, waxed lyrical about the Euro 96 shirts, but this, the Euro 2000 shirts are equally as glorious.
Yeah, note in margin, article, best Italy kits of all time, tick. Right, that's going to get done. Got a lot to thank Kappa for, love a tight shirt. Right, okay, so let's move on.
You do love a tight shirt.
I'm saying that before you say it. So, right, well, let's get straight to it. Let's get to the squads. Okay, I'm just going to do a quick overview of a few people who didn't make it because it's just easy to rush over this because people will listen to when we go through the squad and say, especially this era, and think, why didn't he go? Why didn't he go? So 26-man squad. Here we had midfielders Dino Baggio and Diego Fuser. Both didn't make the squad. Same with defender Giuseppe Pancaro. And also on the final cut for the 22, Christian Vieri was ruled out through injury, which I think we said before this, we were working out what game it was. We think it was Inter v Parma. And Gigi Buffon was originally named in that final 22. He fractured his hand when John Carew, well, big guy John Carew, went absolutely through him. Brave Gigi, but he, a game against Norway in June 2000, and he was replaced by Milan's Christian Abbiati, a divisive character to say the least. So let's start with the goalkeepers. We've no Gigi, and we're left. I'm underwhelmed by this. First of all, this tournament for me is a lot about this man, Francesco Toldo. We'll talk more about this as we go on, certainly will. A tournament where he really did become elite, if he wasn't before that, he was here. And he put himself on the world stage anyway here. But it's the other two, Emmett. Christian Abbiati, no caps at the time, playing for Milan. And then the other goalkeeper is Francesco Antonioli, who also hadn't been capped. These two keepers came to the tournament with a combined age of something. I mean, Abbiati was still quite young at this point, only 22. Antonioli was 30, a bit older. I'm going to argue that if Francesco Toldo gets injured, that Abbiati, I was never a huge fan of his goalkeeping. I always felt he always felt a little unstable for me. No, I'm not unstable, erratic. And Antonioli, I don't even call him a bad goalkeeper, but I would not say he was an international goalkeeper.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's funny when you look back at France 98, which was 2 years prior, Italy's three goalkeepers were Gianluca Pagliuca, Angelo Peruzzi, and Gigi Buffon. And then you've got Abbiati and Antagnoli and Taldo. But obviously, Taldo goes on to have the tournament of his life. You know, like those seven games, he was absolutely remarkable. But yeah, they don't... When you look at it, you just think Italy are lucky that they had Paolo Maldini, Fabio Cannavaro, and Alessandro Nesta playing in front of the goalkeeper. When you're looking at the three yeah. goalkeepers, because having those three in front of you would give you a lot of confidence. Obviously, Taldo plays a pivotal role in Italy getting to the final, as we'll talk about later down the road. But yeah, the goalkeepers don't really instill you with a lot of confidence. You know, as you say, if anything had happened to Taldo during the course of the tournament, Abbiati and Antagnoli, they're good Serie A goalkeepers, but you really wouldn't be putting your life in their hands, no. if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. And so we'll go through to the defenders and we'll skip through these because we've said on all of these podcasts, we normally get a bit overwhelmed when we read the defenders. So I'm interested to know if you think the same from this tournament. We've got Ciro Ferrara, 33. Maldini, 31. He's aging, but well, he's not even... Well, I'll say Maldini's aging. He had a way to go after this. Fabio Cannavaro, Paolo Negro, who's playing at Lazio at the time and not capped hugely. Gianluca Pesotto was also there, another Juventus man coming in. Alessandro Nesta, Lazio, only 24 at the time. Mark Iliano, also at Juventus, big heavy presence here. And so that's your defensive lineup. I still think that, for me personally, this has got some absolute class in it. When you think about the likes of Maldini, you think about the likes of Nesta. You look at it here, and Cannavaro, of course. But then I think the backup of that is good. You know, it's a good defensive team made up from Juventus, and I think it's a great cover. We're probably going to talk about... Should we talk about system now? Because there is a caveat to these defenders, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in terms of defence, absolutely no qualms about any of them. You know, obviously, Zoff implements a 3-5-2 system or a 3-4-1-2 and has Maldini, Cannavaro and Nesta as centre-backs, obviously. You know, having Ciro Ferrara and Paolo Negro and Marco Iuliano as backup, definitely you could do a lot worse than having those three as backup. And Pesotto was a very versatile defender, could play right back, left back, right midfield, left midfield, a bit like Angelo Di Livio. Very, very versatile, and Italian coaches love versatile players.
Yeah, completely, completely. Well, that links in actually now. When we go through the midfield, I mean, again, we'll talk about the midfielders first and I'll pass it on for you for talking about how they link with the system, because Demetrio Albertini, and Angelo Di Livio, because obviously he listens to this, Angelo Di Livio, Antonio Conte, we've also got the likes of Luigi Di Biagio, who spent his whole career being divisive, as well as in coaching. Massimo Ambrosini, again, I'm getting all these names wrong now. Gianluca Zambrotta, who many would have classed as a defender potentially or fullback. Stefano Fiori, and that completes it. Now, I'm a little underwhelmed by that, but am I underwhelmed by it because Zoff brought these players to fit a system?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of like what I talked about in, I think it was the Euro 96 episode. Italy, in the 90s, Italy didn't... Midfield was always underwhelming to me. You know, as we talked about, you know, Dino Baggio doesn't make the cut in this tournament and wouldn't play for Italy again. Di Biagio was at his peak here, and he was a good box-to-box midfielder and could score the odd goal from a corner or, you know, running late into the box. But Italy just didn't produce. They either produced registas like Demetrio Albertini or later Andrea Pirlo, or traquatistas. But that dynamic box-to-box midfield type, Italy really didn't produce a lot of them a lot of them in the 90s. You think when they would face France in the final, the likes of Patrick Vieira or Manu Petit, Italy really didn't produce players in that mould. It was either deep lying or at the tip of a diamond. In the middle, it was like when we go through these squads, the midfield area always is. I always identify the midfield as a weak spot, especially in central midfield. You know, you could, the likes of Angelo Di Livio would play, you know, right midfield or left midfield. And in this tournament, you'd have Stefano Fiore, who would also kind of have a breakout tournament. Gianluca Zambrata, again, good on either wing. But in the central positions, you have Antonio Conte, who at this point is 30. It is very underwhelming, but I think Zoff, maybe, I don't know who else he could have brought to the table at this point. Is there someone I'm missing that you can think of?
No, that's it. When I looked at it at first, I went through the same thought process. I looked at it and thought, okay, he wants to play this 3-5-2. We criticised Vicini for just going, let's just take all of the players who are good, like incredible, and then I'll try and figure it out later on in the tournament, you know, or in the tournament or in the qualifiers for Euro 92. I actually thought, looking at this squad, that Zoff had been clever and he picked players like Conte to be, you know, to lie deep and Zambrotta to get the pace on the wings. And then when I'm moving to the forwards, it's quite obvious Italy had some quality. But when you think about it, like you say, who else? I'm not sure there is that many, a lot more. And I think that's partly to do with them, correct me if I'm wrong now, you are seeing an influx, even more and more foreign players coming into the league from maybe when we talked about, you know, Vicini's squad in the 90s. So maybe that, you know, sends a lack of quality, but it's just little underwhelming from an Italy squad that we hold very high standards.
So, yeah, well, you have to think too that the Bosman rule comes in the summer of 1996. So even from Euro 96 to Euro 2000, we see an influx of foreigners into Serie A. So obviously that would dilute Zoff's pool choice. So and obviously that, you know, the Bosman ruling was monumental, and players had the freedom to move wherever they wanted. So Serie A was no exception at the time, and you got an influx of the best foreigners at the time. But as we go on, you kind of see that the percentage of Italians playing in the top level diminishes greatly, you know. I think I remember Marcello Lippi saying, making the point that in 2006, it was maybe, was it 50% or 52%? And I think now it's in the mid-30s of Italians playing in Serie A now. And this was, you know, obviously back then, the number maybe wasn't as low, but the talent pool was shrinking, so to speak.
Yeah. Definitely. I remember this really good podcast about the best five and worst five Bosman signings in Serie A.
Yeah, I remember that too, actually.
It was good, wasn't it? I think it was somewhere around, I think you can find it on the Gentleman Lodgers podcast. I'm not quite sure. Have a look. Watch this. There'll be a better one out there now. We've just tell everyone to go to. Well, let's go to the forwards. We've got Pippo Inzaghi. What can you say about him? Alessandro Del Piero, who, again, you know, this is some of his peak years, or even, I don't know, it just seemed to be peak for a long time with this man. And then finally, we have the likes of Vincenzo Montella, Francesco Totti, and Marco Del Vecchio. And before anyone raises any eyes at Del Vecchio, this, when you look and you've got those three I've just mentioned, all from Roma, this was one hell of a Roma side. I'm not disappointed with that. Obviously, you'd have still been bringing Baggio, wouldn't you?
Of course. And that is literally what I was going to say. I was going to say, you know what I'm going to say, Baggio should have went. But in saying that...
When we're doing next year's Euro, this year's Euros.
Yeah, you're towards Baggio. 54 years old, bring him on for the last 10 minutes. It's all you need, impact sub. No, but in all seriousness, you know, Del Vecchio, Totti... I think Del Vecchio scored, was it 18 goals or something, or 16 goals for Roma in the 99, you know, the season going into the Euros. Totti, it was his time as the trequartista. Obviously, Christian Vieri was probably you would say in the top three strikers of world football at this time, but obviously he got injured leading into the tournament. Pippo Inzaghi, I actually don't... This wasn't peak Pippo for me. Pippo's peak, he was still at Juventus at this point. His peak would come in the Milan era.
Yeah.
So this is kind of, he's still finding himself. Del Piero, which is something we'll talk about as we get into this, I actually would have left Del Piero at home and brought Baggio because Del Piero was still finding his way back from the major injury. And he went into this tournament, I think he scored 9 or 10 goals in Serie A that season, but they're all penalties. He didn't score from open play, and he was suffering. But in saying that, as was pointed out by one of our readers, the space that Del Piero was afforded by successive Italian managers, even when he wasn't in form, he was always picked, was ludicrous, considering that Baggio wasn't afforded the same credit, so to speak. You know, Del Piero, if you're picking players, if Zoff is bringing players to come to a tournament on form, Del Piero shouldn't have been anywhere near the squad. Because if you watched him for that season with Juve, he was a shadow of himself. He had to readjust. He'd lost the pace, the acceleration of pace that he had pre-injury, as he had put on more muscle in his legs, you know, to cope with tearing his cruciate ligament. So Del Piero was slower, but he had to remodify his game to become more cerebral, shall we say, more, you know, think two steps ahead as opposed to just relying on instinct and his pace to get away from players. But going into the tournament, he was in awful form. You know, he was being picked on his name as opposed to form. And for me, I would have left Del Piero at home and brought Baggio, who wasn't injured, but him and Lippi had the massive feud at Inter, and he wasn't really getting game time. But Del Piero definitely was not there on merit, shall we say.
No, I think that it's weird. That's another podcast. We'll do another podcast about Del Piero and the taking over of Baggio and the difference between the managers, because the relationships, sorry, they have with coaches. For me, very quickly, I think that Del Piero, for whatever reasons, as soon as he replaces Baggio at Juventus, wrongly, it signals not the end of Baggio, but what people think will be, because they're assuming that Baggio then and by then has lost his pace and lost a bit of what he had, and I think they just wrote him off way too soon. But let's get into the qualifiers, because this shouldn't take too long, because normally we have a bit of a dig at Italy, and well, we have been in the past qualifiers, but they finish. It's an interesting one. When you look at Italy, they play 8, win 4, draw 3, and lose 1. Now, they score 13 goals, they concede 5. But, and we'll go through a few of these games, because I don't want to spend too long on this, because we've got a lot to talk about in this tournament. They only qualify and win the group by 1 point. Do you think that was because of the quality of Denmark and Switzerland, the other two in the group being Wales and Belarus? Or do you just think this was a job done? I mean, it can't really be too much more convincing, can it?
Yeah, I mean, Zoff takes over from Cesare Maldini after France 98. And I think he spends, I don't know, Italy in this era just always seemed to just do enough to qualify. And again, we have this succession of very conservative coaches. And considering the talent that Italy had, Italy should be blowing these teams away. You know, the likes of Belarus, Wales, Switzerland, and all, even Denmark, who finished second in the group, in the qualifying group behind Italy by just 1 point. The talent that Italy had, if you have Roberto Mancini now and you put him in charge of Italy in the late 90s with the talent that was at the disposal at the time, Italy really, in theory, should be blowing these teams away, but Italy just always struggled or just did enough to qualify. I mean, they draw against Belarus in the qualifying, actually twice, you know, and they score once. And then they lose to Denmark in Naples in the September 1989. And they just, like, if you look at their goal scorers in the tournament, are in for the qualifying. Pippo Inzaghi and Christian Vieri get 3 goals apiece. Del Piero on 2. Diego Fuser.
That was both in one game as well.
Yeah, like, and Del Piero spent most of that time out injured. So you just think Zoff just about did enough to get Italy over the finish line. But that is the story of Italy in this era. It is. They're too conservative for their own good.
Yeah. Now, I've got a question for you on this. Just we'll focus specifically on this tournament. But so Italy's first game is Switzerland. They play in the Friuli. Okay, there's 35,000 there. They play in Ancona, the Stadio del Canaro, 20,000. You know, then they play in the Dallara, Bologna. Yes, I particularly like it. But there's only 24,000 there. No, and it, obviously these teams can fit more. Maybe not Ancona's. I don't particularly know the attendance. Okay, there's 50,000 in Naples. You'd think that if Italy play everything in Rome and they just have that more, you know, I don't know whether it makes a difference, but sometimes I think that when teams move away, and I understand why they do it, they travel the country, they want to get the support, they want to try and bring that in so everyone sees and gets invested in the tournament behind the team. Understandable. But do you think it makes any difference? Do you think it just loses a little bit? Or do you think it would have had more if everything had been in the Olympico?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. I understand the concept behind it. It's almost like Harlem Globetrotters. You know, we want to take Italy to every part of the country, and it's not fair. You know, say Italian fans in Sardinia can't get to see the Azzurri if they're playing every game at the Stadio Olimpico. So I like the idea and concept, but as you can see by the meager turnout in a lot of stadiums, you know, as you say, they get 24,000 in the Dell'Ora, but the Dell'Ora can hold, what, 35,000?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the appetite for Italy during this era wasn't, because they weren't blowing teams away. Italy were not producing exciting football. And I think it was, maybe the feeling was it was just a given that Italy would qualify, considering the group, you know, Switzerland, Wales, Denmark. They're not teams that fill you full of excitement. And maybe you're right, if they had been just, you know, obviously like England do with Wembley. Every game is at Wembley and it's a sellout. Maybe if it's at the Olympico, every game they get 50, 60,000. Or maybe they don't. Maybe it is just...
Yeah, there's only a theory. It's,
yeah, maybe there is just a real relative, just a meh.
Apathy or something, to say, yeah.
Yeah, just like, well, Italy will qualify, you know, maybe. And maybe it does, if there is every game at the Olympico, you only get 20, 30, 40,000, and which maybe even looks worse than getting 24,000 in the Stadio Dall'Ora. So, again, we're theorising here, but you never really know.
Absolutely. So they end up going. They are drawn. Excuse me. They are then drawn in a group that consists of Belgium, Sweden, and Turkey. Now, just very quickly before we go through and ask you some questions on this group, this for me, this Belgium team, you look down and whilst, you know, for me, the great Belgium team, probably even in the recent era, and especially 1990. But there's still some good players here. I mean, Emilien Penza, if you remember, was still seen as a big, you know, talent at this point. You had Luc Nielis, who was the old man of football by then. You know, the likes of Philippe de Vilde was a good player. But he wasn't a peak Belgium team for me. I don't know if you think you... How would you rate it? I mean, I look at this squad and think, okay, Mark Wilmots is a good player. You know, there's some experience in here, especially with the likes of Lorenzo Stalens. But it's not screaming the quality of, you know, the Enzo Schifo, Kleistus, Kuhlemans, Prudhomme 90s team, or, you know, the team that consists of Lukaku and co today.
Yeah, like when you mention Emilien Penza, I just think Championship Manager 0102 legend. I mean, yeah, it's a decent Belgium squad, but again, it's probably not the squad or the team of Italia 90 or USA 94.
I mean, they are hosts as well, co-hosts, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, they've qualified purely on the basis of hosting the tournament or being co-hosts. But I mean, yeah, Luc Nielis still, maybe he was 30, 31 at this point. was still a quality player. Impenso was seen as a great, you know, a great prospect. Branko Struper, I think a Derby County legend, if I remember correctly. A decent Belgium side, but when you look at the group, you think Italy and Sweden probably would qualify. I definitely think Sweden were a much better team at the turn of the century than Belgium were. I mean, if you look at the Sweden side, you know, they've obviously Henrik Larsson, who was in his pomp at Celtic. And you've got Kenneth Anderson of Bologna fame. for Freddie Ljungberg, Johan Mjalby, Patrick Anderson, who I think was at Barcelona or Bayern Munich at that time. Olaf Melberg, Magnus Hedman, who was at Coventry.
Where was Joachim Björklund at in 2000? Because he'd done his travels, hadn't he? When did he was at Sunderland? That was later on, was it? I can't quite remember, but...
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. But, I mean, Daniel Anderson, is that Daniel Anderson who played for Barry?
You make me think... I was thinking of... Yeah, he was.
So, I mean, you know, that this is a good Sweden side. And when you look at the group, you think, Italy and Sweden... You know, obviously, you know, Turkey also had some good players, and they would reach the Final Four 2 years later in Japan and South Korea.
Yeah, you're right, because I just looked at it. Joachim Björklund's actually at Valencia at this point. So they're all out. These two, you know, they're a solid outfit that look, when you look at it, you think, okay, Lundberg's a big difference maker in midfield. Like, you know, the likes of Henrik Larsson, that is, and Kenneth Anderson can do something. But the rest of it is just one of those Swedish teams where you're just going to have Mjölby sitting in back front of the back four. And it's like, come on, break us down. But we actually have got some pace to break on you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Turkey, you know, Turkey now, at that stage, Hakan Şükür.
A legend.
The legend, the Inter icon.
Emmet Davila seems to be at Milan.
Milan.
And Inter. Rusty Rekabar, though, we've got to note him. I mean, he's looking into this tournament. And, you know, he's seriously rated at this point. I mean,
yeah.
He's still at Fenerbahce, soon to go to Barcelona. It's a great team. And, I mean, you look at, like, sort of Okan Buruk was good. He might not, was it as good as a few years before?
I don't know. I think by the time they get to 2002, they're a better side. And you've Emre breaking through, another Inter legend. Inter must have signed a lot of Turkish players at this point.
What was he? Who was the coach?
Fatih Terim, was it? No.
Fatih Terim.
Fiorentina legend.
I mean, it's a good team. Like, you are right, though. You know, it's a team on the up, and they've been building this for years, it felt like, within the late 90s, because when I was talking about, you look at Galatasaray, you had a lot of those players, you know, obviously led by Hagi of Romania, but that team, you could seem to be able to name Fenerbahce and Galatasaray probably from about 98 till it, probably after 2002 when, you know, everyone started picking them off. But,
yeah, well, I mean, Galatasaray win the UEFA Cup this year, if you remember. They beat Leeds in the semi-final in tragic circumstances, and then they defeat Arsenal in penalties in the final.
Penalties, yeah.
So, I mean, it just shows you that Galatasaray were a good side, and obviously that fed into the Turkish national side, because many players obviously come from Galatasaray. But Turkey and Italy kick off the first game, and Italy win 2-1 with a very uncharacteristic, spectacular overhead kick from Antonio Conte, of all people.
It is brilliant.
But it's interesting to note that, again, we talked about the conservatism of Zoff. I mean, he starts with a five-man backline, a 5-3-2 against Turkey, with all due respect to Turkey. Like, starting with five defenders is ludicrous. Yeah.
I think it was because, you know, Italy, much maligned, much criticised, obviously, that we all know about the media there. And this Turkey side, we said, was quite an offensive side. Do you think he just wanted to sort of drag this result out and give them confidence and get those early 3 points?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of as we talked about with the Arrigo Sacchi in Euro 86. When you're first, when you're opening two games, and then just take it from there. And obviously, you know, but I actually, looking at this team now against Turkey, I actually like this team. You know, you've Taldo in nets, Zambrata right wing back or right back, Cannavaro, Nesta, Maldini, Passato on the opposite flank, Albertini and Conte in central midfield, and Stefano Fiore behind Totti and Inzaghi. Like, I like that setup. That is a very good, you know, there's no real weak links in that team. You know, Stefano Fiore was kind of an unknown quantity at this point, but he would have the tournament of his life. Like, he, if I remember correctly, he wins a big move to Parma off the back of this, or maybe it's Lazio, off the back of this tournament.
And yeah, he does. It's Lazio in 2001, I think. Didn't he end up in Spain at some point?
Yeah, he goes to, Claudio Ranieri brings him to Valencia in like 2004, 2005. Oh.
He brought a couple of players over there. That's another podcast, but yeah, he did get over there, and he did really seem to make himself there, didn't he?
Yeah, like this was his, again, like Taldo, this was his breakout tournament. So Italy win 2-1, and Inzaghi scores a penalty, and it kind of shows you the depth that Italy had, where they could bring on Del Piero as a sub, and Angelo Di Livio also makes a brief appearance. But I like this setup. You know, and you can see, obviously, as we alluded to earlier, Zoff brought players to fit a system. But it wasn't as crazy as Sacchi 4 years earlier. You know, it makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, Italy see off Turkey relatively comfortable. Obviously, Turkey snatched one back through Okan. Again, another Inter legend, Okan. If I remember correctly, if I'm thinking of the right player. Like, Inter and Milan must have signed, honestly, about 75% of these Turkish players in this period.
Pretty much.
So then, you know, 3 days later, because at this point you still have a 16-team tournament, so games are coming thick and fast. Every 3 days they're playing. You know, the 14th of June, they play Belgium. And again, a 2-0 victory. Francesco Totti scores a header. What is it? Conte with an overhead kick and Totti with a header. What is going on?
Not right. Again, though, it's that system again. You know, Maldini playing as a wing, almost like a wing back. Nesta is almost like a sweeper in a sense, isn't it? And then you've got Conte, Albertini holding, and Fiore again, you know, up there. And when you look at that compared to Belgium, Belgium almost matched that position. Almost, apart from the fact that you've got a real, it's almost like a, maybe more of a diamond, maybe the likes that Van der Hage is just playing in front of the defence on this one, rather than as deep as Nesta is. Could you do think here that the only difference between these two teams is that Belgium could potentially expose them wide, but do you think that the work rates of Albertini and Conte here just really, really makes because I always think that they were the ones who really broke down that wide play, and then they could still play into the back three while Zambrotta and Maldini bombed on the counter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, both of us know Conte, having obviously me being of the Juventus persuasion and you of the Inter persuasion, that Conte as a player had such ferocious tenacity and would cover every blade of grass. Because he lacked, you know, the technical ability of a Totti, of a Baggio, of a Del Piero. So he made up for it in determination. So he was brilliant at shutting down the opposition. You know, you probably couldn't ask for a better player than Antonio Conte to carry out the gritty side of football. And then you obviously have Maldini and Zambrata, who have great engines. And this is a very young Gianluca Zambrata. And even Maldini at 31 still has a great engine, bomb up and down, no problem. So, I mean, yeah, definitely they would shut down the Belgium attack on both flanks. And again, it's just a very nice setup. And obviously, Stefano Fiore scores a wondrous goal. I think it's he plays a 1-2 with Inzaghi in a central position just outside the box and curls a delicious shot into the, not the top corner, but kind of in the middle of the net in the corner, like not top corner, not bottom corner, but just in the middle. Just a beautifully delicious curled shot.
And finds Fiore. And Fiore will hit it. What a thumping goal! It's a brilliant strike from Stefano Fiore. And Italy are 2 goals to the good, and surely there's no way back for Belgium now. Well, that really was a tremendous strike, one of the best that we've seen in Europe.
Which kind of then that started people taking notice of Stefano Fiore. But I mean, 2 wins from 2, Italy more or less through. And they can kind of take it easy then for the third game against Sweden. But I mean, yeah, just a very, very two accomplished performance from Italy. And Zoff managed to do what Sacchi didn't do. You know, he kept most of the same squad, the same team for the second game and got the win.
Absolutely. Like you say, there's some alterations in that. The game against Sweden at the end, and they go on to win 2-1 with Di Biagio and Del Piero scoring. So the interesting thing here is that we talked about it not looking like a group that was going to be easy to get through, but 3 wins out of 3, 6 goals scored, 2 conceded, and with 9 points, they don't look back, because the nearest team to them was Turkey with 4 points. And they march on then to the latter stages of the tournament. And I think they could say, now they're here, they're looking with confidence. And the matchups here in that the quarterfinals, you've got Spain and France. Turkey are going to take on Portugal. Netherlands are going to take on Yugoslavia and destroy Yugoslavia 6-1. And they will obviously face Italy if Italy can beat Romania. And again, you know, we talk about this in Romania. I'll just quickly go through this squad. When you call it back, I think it's pretty much, you know, any time between 96 probably going to here. 94 to here. He's looking quite an interesting squad. Bogdan Stelaric's goal is a decent goalkeeper for Romania. You had the likes of Cristian Chivu, the magnificent Georgi Hagi, and we'll talk a little bit about him later. Daniel Montano, Vladan Moldovan, who was an excellent player, and the legendary Adrian Muti. Good team, this, isn't it? Good team. It's going to be 4-4-2, but you knew what you were going to get. Well, apart from with Hagi.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Hagi at this point, I think, was 35. And this actually would be his last international game, because he retires from international football after this tournament. And it's a sad way to go out, because he gets sent off and he picks up 2 yellow cards in the space of 5 minutes and gets sent. And if I remember right, one of them was a kick. He kicks out at someone. My memory is a little bit hazy of this game, but yeah, I mean, again, Italy go with a 5-3-2, and again, it's just another accomplished performance. And Romania at this time, it's, you know, for younger listeners of our podcast, during this era, Romania were just always a given that they were at tournaments. You know, this was their golden age. USA 94, they lit up the tournament. They were at Euro 96. Again, didn't do so much. They went out in the group stage. France 98, they qualified for France 98. If I remember rightly, they got to the round of 32 in France 98. And then they're here at Euro 2000. So, I mean, in this period, Romania was always more or less a given to be at tournaments. And it's at this stage, you know, the likes of Popescu and Dimitrescu and Florin Radicaiu, they'd long retired, and Hagi was kind of one of the last remaining figures from that great USA 94 side. And you've youngsters like Adrian Mutu and Cristian Chivu breaking through, but Italy are just too much for them. I think, you know, Hagi, his best days were obviously behind him at this stage. There's still magic in that left foot, but he couldn't cover the same ground that he could have, you know, 5 or 6 years previously. And again, Italy just picked them off. You know, Totti and Inzaghi scoring, and Zoff kept more or less the same team intact from the first 2 games. He obviously reinstates Totti and Inzaghi to the starting lineup. Conte's back, Albertini's back. Giuliano actually players in this game at the expense of Tiro Ferrara, Maldini on the left and Brad on the right, just, and he can afford to bring on Luigi Di Biagio and Del Piero late in the game. But just a real...
It's like in the last game against Sweden, though, he mixed it up. Like Iliano in the Greek game, the last one, he gave a few a little bit of a game, didn't he? So he could just prepare.
Yeah, and I mean, that's how you manage a tournament.
Exactly.
You know, which is something that Sacchi never learned. You win your first two games, you qualify, and then you can tinker in the third game when there's not a whole lot riding on that result. But yeah, I mean, this was a job well done. In and out, 2-0 victory, and they're into the semi-final.
And now, you mentioned it, the semi-final against Holland.
The game.
Yeah, well, there's no point talking. We're only trying to keep these podcasts to an hour. We could do an hour on this alone.
Yeah,
I'll let you talk about a couple of changes in the Italian squad, but I'm just going to go down this lineup. I'm not going to talk about the whole team, but this is Frank Rijkaard in charge of this team. And I think it's a spectacular Dutch team. People were comparing it probably to other great Dutch teams of the late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. They've had a lot of good teams. But you've got Edwin van der Sar in goal, who was phenomenal. Paul Bosvelt, good right back. Jaap Stam and Frank de Boer at centre back. Left back, Giovanni Bram Bronckhorst, who essentially was underrated in my opinion. Right mid, you've got Mark Overmars, whose pace was phenomenal. Philip Cocu, whose passing was phenomenal. And Edgar Davids, who just generally was phenomenal. Then there's Budvin Zenden, and then the front two, my God, Patrick Kluivert and Dennis Bergkamp. People like Van Vossen, Seedorf and Winter on the bench. I mean, this Dutch team's, it's epic, isn't it?
Imagine when you're in a position where you can bring a 24-year-old Clarence Seedorf off the bench. Like, how good is your midfield? And
you want to know who didn't go? I want to find out afterwards who did not go to this tournament, because there will have been some boys from Ajax that you're coming through in those 2000s who, you know, who won't have gone to this tournament. I mean, it's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal team.
Yeah, and I mean,
you understand why Zoff goes with a back five here as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. If you're going to go for a back five this against the likes of Bergkamp and Kluivert, this is the game. But it's interesting that he starts Del Piero and drops Totti for this game, and he starts Pippo and Zaghi and Del Piero together. And if you remember, at this point, these two did not get along. There obviously was the famous game in the season leading into this tournament against Venezia, where Pippo scores a hat-trick, and there's a couple of opportunities where he could pass the ball to Del Piero, and Del Piero, obviously his confidence was lacking coming back from the injury, and he couldn't score from open play, but Pippo, just with the tunnel vision, would not pass to anybody, and he scores a hat-trick, and Del Piero, you can just see Del Piero just being furious that Pippo didn't score the ball. Del Piero was completely unmarked, and Pippo was just like, nah, I'm going for a goal, I want my hat-trick, you know. And it's interesting that he starts these two in a semi-final, and Totti is dropped. But yeah, I mean, as you say, we could literally cover an hour podcast on this game alone.
What I'll do is I'll give everyone a little overview of this game, and then you can just, I'll do it as if I'm sort of reading the news on it or something. You can just then pick out the best bit, because I mean, this is Toldo at the peak. But basically, Zoff makes two changes to the game against Romania. Di Biagio comes in, replacing Conte is injured, and Totti, you rightly say, makes one for Del Piero. So, I mean, Holland really, they really did start well, didn't they? Third minute, Bergkamp lobs, three-putting Cocu on goal. Bergkamp then strikes a post not too long afterwards, and it just looks for ages that it's going to be Holland's game. Even better then, Zambrotta gets his second yellow card. 4 minutes later, it just looks as though the Italians are going to be absolutely overrun when Nesta holds back Patrick Kluivert, and it's a penalty. So this is where Toldo thinks, right, you know, we are up against it now. And the ball comes up, Toldo goes to his left, and I'm not even paying Toldo enough credit for this save or all the saves that come in. And then it carries on from there. So what you've got to say about this is that Zoff changes his mindset, and besides them being a couple of goals down, Fiori and Del Piero both then start to have a few shots on goal, and they really start to make it hard for Holland to really find any sort of rhythm at all. But it carries on from the Dutch. I mean, Kluivert hits a post. The resulting penalty. Sorry, there's another penalty, Davids goes down under Iliana's challenge. Kluivert hits the post. This is where, Toldo is just phenomenal. And you just think that it's going to come at some point. There's so many different things we could talk for, like Van Bronckhorst effort, Overmars, and the tie goes into extra time. And obviously this is the era where it's a golden goal. But saying that, it's Van der Sar who actually denies Del Vecchio late on with his feet. But the game ends up going to penalties. I mean, I couldn't do that justice. But, I mean, do you want to just... Anything I missed out, and then do you want to take us through the penalties?
No, I think you've covered it pretty well. But just
I was rushing through it because it's just like there's nothing you can. It's unbelievable.
Obviously the Zambrada sending off, you know, changes the game and how the game was shaped. But it morphs into Dutch attacking against Italian defending. You know, it almost resorts to stereotypical cliches, and it is, the game morphs into, honestly, I think probably the very last time that Italy played to their strengths, i.e. Catenaccio, you know, every man back behind the ball, breaking the counter. This is probably the last time that you ever see it at an international tournament. And the game almost, as I said, the game almost, it just falls into, you know, each respective country's philosophies on the game. You know, the Dutch like to attack, the Italians like to defend, but obviously in this situation, it's Italy's whatever game plan that Zoff had goes out the window because of Zambrada's. I mean, he sent off in the 34th minute, you know. So any plan that he had, tactical plan that he had, you know, maybe to attack later in the game, goes out the window, and it is literally just backs to the wall for the rest of the game. But it's a masterclass in Italian defending, even though the Dutch missed two penalties. It's just, you know, Nesta, Cannavaro, Maldini and Giuliano are exceptional.
That's exceptional as Toldo.
Toldo is monstrous in this game. Monstrous.
If anyone hasn't seen this, we can't do justice with words. Go and have a look at this, or just type in Toldo in YouTube against Holland, and even that's good enough. I mean, there were whole games worth watching. But it goes to penalties now. Both teams at this era would have been absolutely scared. I'm not going to say the word, but they would have been very scared and nervous about penalties because neither team had a fantastic record.
Well, when you think of France 98, the Dutch went out on penalties against Brazil in the semi-final, and Italy, well, we all know Italy's record with penalties. They went out to France in France 98 and USA 94 and Italia 90. So both sides didn't have the greatest. And I think the Dutch went out of Euro 96 on penalties. I'm nearly sure. So, I mean, both sides don't have great track records at this point with penalty shootouts. And transpires... Yes, right, against Germany. So, I mean, what transpires on the Dutch side is absolutely... It's laughable. What happens?
So, I mean, I mean, it is. I mean, we'll go very quickly. I mean, do you want to go through the pens or just really quickly, or should we move on to the final now? Because we think we've talked a lot about that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll just briefly say Italy actually win a penalty shootout for a change for the first time in probably decades.
So Luigi Di Biagio puts the ball on the spot. Van der Sar stares him down the barrel. Di Biagio makes it this time.
Di Biagio scores. Frank de Boer misses. Gianluca Pissarro scores, Yapstam hits the ball up into Mars. I don't think that ball has come down yet. I mean, people always give Robbie Baggio abuse for his penalty in the final of USA 94 going over the bar. But Yapstam's penalty in this game, I mean, it probably hit a plane that was flying overhead somewhere in Holland. Because, I mean, he just puts his whole force behind it. And, I mean, row Z would be a compliment to Yapstam. Taddy, of course, scores his kukyao, the spoon, the dink, panenka, whatever you want to call it. And obviously, and he tells Maldini what he's going to do before he does it. And Maldini's like, he's not going to go for the kukyao, is he? The chip. And of course, it's the perfect panenka. I mean, just floats it in the air. And it just, time stands still. And it just drops just behind the line. I mean, you talk about technique. Absolutely brilliant. Kluivert scores for Holland. Maldini actually misses for Italy. But then Posvelt misses for Holland. And Italy are through. Actually, miraculously make it through a penalty shootout for once. And into the final.
That's right. It's into the final against France. Obviously, winners in 1998. They went through against Portugal in a 2-1 win with Henry. And Zidane scored. And Nuno Gomes, quality player, scored for the Portuguese. And so it brings us to the final. Now, Italy, you know, go into this final in the De Kuip Stadium in Rotterdam. And they make, well, Liano still at the back with Nestor and Cannavaro. And we also see Del Vecchio start for it in this game. But I'll just quickly go through that France squad. He started in that game. You've got Fabien Barthez, Lilian Thuram, Desailly, Laurent Blanc, Lizard Azou, Vieira, Deschamps, Djorkaeff, Zinedine Zidane, Henri and Degaye, with Wiltord, Trezeguet and Pires on the bench, notably David Trezeguet there. Very symptomatic and very similar, should I say, to the squad that won in 1998. Memories of this final, I just think that, you know, it's... Del Vecchio puts Italy up for 55 minutes.
Beautiful, beautiful backheel from Totti into the path.
Unbelievable.
Pissarro to set it up. Like, Totti, this was Totti's best tournament for Italy. Make no mistake about it. And the expectation wasn't on him as much as it would be in subsequent tournaments in the 2002 World Cup and Euro 2004, when it was kind of seen as, right, this is his tournament. He is Italy's star player. But he wins man of the match for the final and he makes the team in the tournament. So this is Totti's first and his best international tournament for Italy. And everything else that came after that was kind of underwhelming. But, I mean, if you look at the France team, there's so much Serie A experience running right through that France squad. You know, Djorkaeff played for Inter. Zizou was at Juve at the time. Deschamps, obviously Juve stalwart. Patrick Vieira, a brief stint at Milan. Marcel Desailly, what, 5 years at Milan. Lilian Thuram, then at Parma. You know, this was almost like Italy against a Serie A 11. Yeah, in really, some respects.
Yeah. And was Christophe Dugarry, was he at Milan?
He was at Milan 96, 97. He was there for a cup of coffee and then he was sold on. And Henri had 6 months at Juve, the year before. So, I mean, this was a very, you know, these players would have known each other inside and out for the most part.
Absolutely. So, we're 1-0 up. We're looking at Italy 1-0 up. 55 minutes gone. And you look at it and you think, despite all the quality in this squad, it's working. Zoff is seeing out this final just like he's seen out the rest of the entire tournament. It's going to be a stalwart game where the quality will do what it needs to do. But you're looking at that back five, really, you know, containing the likes of Henri Djorkaeff. Dugarry potentially ineffective. He's hooked off after 58 minutes. Sylvain Vilsort comes on. Trezeguet then comes on 76 minutes for Yura Djorkaeff. And then they go more attacking as they go towards the end of the game as Lizarazu is taking off and Robert Pires comes on. But that's an 86 minutes and the score's still the same. But then, Emmett, but then.
If I remember correctly, it's a mistake from Cannavaro. Cannavaro he lets the ball, he attempts to either win a header or he misjudges the flight of the ball and it lets in Wiltord. Wiltord takes one touch, sets it out of his feet and just smashes a low, drives a low shot that just squirms under Taldo.
And it's answer the question, because Taldo had the tournament of his life. Was Taldo at fault for this?
I don't think so. It's the kind of shot that's too close. To me, the fault's at Cannavaro. Cannavaro didn't read the situation as he should have. And Cannavaro was experienced at that point. He should have known better, a man of his quality. So I don't really blame Taldo. It's the kind of shot that's too close to the body. You know, he wasn't outstretched. It was more under his midriff. So to me, there's no real fault with Taldo on this goal. Anyway, definitely not. It's more canon to me. The finger has to be pointed at Cannavaro.
So we're in extra time now. Now this is the year of, well, not just the year, but the golden goal is still in place, and you really think that Italy can maybe hold out. You know, maybe they can drag this through to penalties. You know, maybe it could go, but I'll let you talk about this one because I believe it starts on the left-hand side, if memory serves. And since he's a, since I'll let you talk about it, since Trezeguet was a Juventus player, what did he go into?
Well, funny, it's Robert Pires. Robert Pires skips past Passato, a young Robert Pires, and he pulls, this is on the left-hand side, Pires skips past Passato, or it's a Giuliano. It's one of the two. And runs down to the byline, reverses the ball back into the centre of the penalty area. And Trezeguet, what I've always loved about this goal is Trezeguet's technique. The way he arches his back and his left foot and how it comes across his right foot. It's his figure is, it's just, it's marvellous. Just to look at the body shape that he gets, that he puts himself in to make full contact. Because that's not an easy, the ball skids off the surface. It's not an easy cross to control when you're shooting first time. It's not like Trezeguet takes one touch to control and then shoots in the second. He does everything in the one movement, the one shot, and he just connects. You couldn't ask for a sweeter connection with the ball.
Trezeguet is waiting in the centre. Trezeguet! Have won the European Championship to add to the World Cup. The first nation ever to do it that way round. Allez les Bleus! Running in the final of the European Championship.
And he just sends a rocket into the roof of the net. And Taldo has absolutely no chance. And I'm nearly sure it's Alessandro Nesta who Trezeguet loses. Nesta's kind of all at sea, and Trezeguet just pulls his left leg back and just smashes the ball into the roof of the net. And Trezeguet had signed for Juve literally like 2 or 3 days before the final took place. He was going from Monaco to Juve, and this was the golden goal. And the league he was going to join, he's just defeated them to win the Euros. And there would have been, at this point, it was 103 minutes on the clock. And I think golden goal was still a point. And then you remember there was silver goal for a period of time. And I think that came into play around Euro 2004, maybe.
Terrible idea.
But yeah, I wasn't really a fan of golden goal either. But it was more, I think, UEFA's desire to make extra time a bit more attacking as opposed to both sides being conservative and waiting for penalties.
Yeah, definitely.
And you kind of have to admire France because they didn't want it to go to penalties. They wanted to win the game in extra time, whereas Italy were, at this point, Zoff was kind of waiting for penalties, you know, just seeing out the 30 minutes.
I think it's Roger Lemar was sort of forced into that, because I said before, when he takes off Lizard Aziz for Pires, okay, you know, you're looking at the likes of Djorkaeff's come off, they put on the extra forward by now. It was all to get that goal back in 90 minutes. They get it. And then I don't think they could have done anything else but attack because the players they had on the pitch in the mix But yeah, they still had to go and do it, and they still did. And that was the end of Euro 2000 to Italy. Now, normally we'd do a little review of that, but we're running really short on time. So we have a couple of questions, Emmett, from our listeners. So we're just going to give some short answers to these. And yeah, I can't remember what they are. I think you know them, don't you?
Yeah, so we have a question from, apologies if I'm saying this name wrong, Aaron Perez Perez.
I reckon that's going to be something to do with the final.
Aaron Mamalotti. Apologies, Aaron, if I'm saying your name wrong. But Aaron wrote in and asked, just how bad was Del Piero in Euro 2000? And I will answer this one. Del Piero was pretty bad in this tournament. Which we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. And if you cast your mind back to the final, Del Piero misses two glitched edge opportunities when Italy would have been out of sight. One was at 1-0.
Del Piero to the left. Oh, it's Del Piero for Italy! And he's missed it.
Very wanted to play Del Piero onside. First touch, second touch, very good out of his feet. And
He slipped through by Totti. And he drags it wide from just inside the penalty box. And this was in normal time. And he scored another one in extra time, which would have been the golden goal. Italy would have won. And again, he puts it wide. Both times, he's Barthez to beat. You know, there's no defenders in front of him. And he puts both opportunities wide. And this, to me, this sums up Del Piero in this period. Del Piero, as I said at the beginning of the episode, shouldn't have been at the tournament. And as I've said it, I've maintained it since it happened. If that's Robbie Baggio and you give him them two chances, he puts one of them away and Italy win the Euros. And Del Piero, I don't know why coaches kept choosing Del Piero when going into tournaments, a lot of the times he didn't deserve to be there. And in Euro 2000, he was terrible. Absolutely awful.
He didn't really shake those misses off until they won the semi-final against Germany in 2006. Go on, next question, Eric.
We have one from Frank. Frank Rosado, part of the TGU alumni. He asks, did this side lay the foundations for 2006?
Yes, move on. Sorry, Frank, I'm only joking. I think he did. I think he did because obviously, you know, Toldo was always a great backup after that, and Buffon comes back. If you look at the likes of Cannavaro. I mean, for me, the likes of Del Piero and Francesco Totti, even though Totti only just made that being injured. But I think what it did, it gave Italy belief that they could go somewhere in a major tournament. I believe it gave a lot of players who were quite young at that time a real belief that they could get somewhere. And I also think it gave them a hunger that they wanted to win something. So from a mental point of view, and as we talked about with Dino's off, I think that Italy could go to a tournament and it wasn't, you know, they didn't have to win playing spectacular football, which was the expectations of the time. Football was changing, we've got to remember at this point. But it gave some belief in the old system and some hunger to the players, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I mean, by the time you get to 2006, a lot of these players had retired, like Maldini never won an international tournament. You know, the likes of Albertini, Conte, Fiore, even Christian Vieri never won a World Cup. A lot of the players have moved on. But yeah, I do agree. You have that Nesta Cannavaro backline, which was integral, you know, in much later tournaments. And obviously, you have Totti, Del Piero was still around the squad. So that final, obviously the defeat spurred Italy on. And you think that this generation of players would eventually win something. And that does happen 6 years later. Owen McHale, apologies Owen if I say your second name wrong. Albertini being completely underrated, had an excellent tournament, immense in the final. What do you think about Albertini? Do you think he's underrated in the pantheon of Italian midfielders?
Yes, I do, I think. Just because he could do everything in the midfield. We talk about, you know, there wasn't a specific player who could move the ball around, you know, like you're saying, box to box. But I do think that he is underrated because when you look back over, you know, some of his old games or his highlight reels, his range of passing was fantastic. You know, his tackling was good. And his intelligence, more than anything, the movement, And also, he came up with a good couple of goals, maybe more for club football. But yeah, I agree. I think he is an underrated player in this tournament. But in Italian football as a whole, I think he's one of those unfortunate players who did an unspectacular job, but a very important job at a time where Serie A was just surrounded with fantastic world-class players.
Yeah, and I think as history has... as time has went on, Albertini's kind of become overshadowed by Pirlo. Pirlo was a more of a flashy regista as opposed to Albertini. Albertini didn't really, you know, spray long balls, diagonal balls, 50, 60 yards into, you know, into the path of swashbuckling right-backs or left-backs the way Pirlo did for Milan and Juve. But Albertini was just, he was always a very neat and tidy footballer. He did the simple things, did it well. And he definitely, I don't think he gets the recognition that he that his talent deserved.
100%.
We have another one from at Shirt Lane. Where does the Euro 2000 kit rank amongst other Italian shirts at tournaments? I think we can cover this one. But yeah, it's definitely amongst the top for me. And Kevin B. But Baggio omission, if there was no alternative choice for Del Piero, he wasn't fully fit.
Ask that. We've got. Don't ask about that.
What do you think? Should Baggio have went or not?
I think in hindsight, when you look back and you look at the season Baggio was having, the sort of player he was, even at, you know how he was doing then, he would have given Italy something different, something really different. And Emmett's point before about the season Del Piero had had. I think that when I look back, I think he should have gone. What I'm unsure about is whether how he would have performed in this system, potentially, I think, well. But also, I do understand the reasons of why he didn't go, because of the way the relationships, as we've covered all this, but the relationships he had, and the way that I think the view of him in Italy was at the time, which was... for me, very unfair. It was almost as soon as you left Juventus, people thought it was finished, and they were all wrong.
Yeah, I mean, in this, as we've discussed in this system, he could have played as a second striker or as a number 10, you know, replacing. He could have, he was 33, he could have went as an impact sub and just brought him on for 15, 20 minutes, and he would have made a difference. And again, if you put Baggio in front of those chances that Del Piero had in the final, Italy win, as far as I'm concerned. You know, one-on-one, there wasn't many better than Baggio. You know, Ronaldo El Fenomeno was brilliant at ticking the ball around the goalkeeper. So was Baggio. And you could foresee, envision that scenario where Baggio puts, you know, exercises the demons of USN 84 and scores one of those chances in the final.
That's a point, of course. No, Baggio shouldn't have gone because there was a penalty shootout in the semi-finals.
Right, so we'll end it on
that note. Here, I'm overrun by Miles, but I'm going to say ciao for now. So thank you, Emmett, and please comment in the comment section below. Just tell us what you think of this, and the next one is coming up soon. Ciao for now.